The Six Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen filling in for Chuck Price today, and he's tending to other business today. But we do have a good show for you despite his absence, and that is that Kevin Stege of the Baker Colson CPA firm is here with me. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. I don't know if I make it that good of a show, but we should still have a good show regardless.
Well, I was just going to leave and see what happened, so... Actually, no.
That would be a bad show.
That would be a bad choice. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think you'd do just great. I think I could take a nap and it would be fun.
Well, this isn't a repeat of last week, other than the fact that he is not here again. But we do know he is taking care of business. I think he's he's getting mental refreshment. But also, I think he's on getting some education too.
Yeah, that was my impression. He was taking some courses or something.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, folks, this is an interactive show, and that means that we like to talk to you. So if you have any questions or comments about estate planning, about taxes, about real estate, about you can talk about investing, anything you want to talk about that might be legal or accounting-wise, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you just want to kind of comment on the show, we would love to hear from you. And it really makes it work because while we try to anticipate or think of subjects that you might be interested in, for example, we're going to do some nice subjects today, and maybe this will spark some of your curiosity. We're going to do a couple of things. We're going to talk about some common transactions that pop up in both of our practices. And one of them is what happens when you transfer an LLC, transfer a real property to a limited liability company. It's a fairly common transaction, comes up in estate planning and real estate. And we're going to talk about the kind of the do's and don'ts and the pluses and minuses and, you know, try to explain how it works a little bit. We're also going to talk about the benefits and pitfalls of a lease option kind of transactions. And this is also a fairly common transaction that comes up sometimes in the context of a family, sometimes in the context of just individuals, or it can even come up in a commercial context. And we're going to be looking at that as to, you know, what's good about it, what's not so good, what to watch out for, those kinds of things. And then one of the things we're talking on a business matter, we're going to take a look at, if we get that far, we're going to talk about sort of the differences between independent contractors and employees and how they differ and how they work, how you can utilize them if your business can utilize them at all, or what to watch out for if you think that you're utilizing independent contractors and, in fact, you're not. So, and that's a big problem area in the law and in the taxation side. It's a big area where people have some issues. So we're going to get to that. And along the way, we might even, you know, pick up a few new things from you. So just to repeat our telephone numbers, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And toll-free 800-990-0750, 990-0750. And if you would like to call in and give us a question or anything, we would love to hear from you because it does more fun that way. And we don't want this to be a lecture, so we're going to kind of structure our discussion as more of a discussion. So you can just join our discussion if you'd like, if you want to consider it that way. Either way, the more of you that call, the more interesting it gets because we don't always know exactly what you want to hear, but we're going to start out with stuff anyway. So What do you think, Kevin? You think we're,
I was going to say maybe to kick us off, we had a caller who didn't get on the air last week that had a situation that I think is fairly common. And, you know, we're going to be talking about common situations here, and maybe we'll start with that. It was, and just to briefly go over the situation, you have a parent that has a vacation home, and you have one beneficiary, one child, in the picture, and the parent doesn't have over $1 million, and they have two homes, and they're land rich, cash poor possibly, and are needing some money out of that vacation home. Well, what's the best way to get that money out? And one of the issues is with this vacation home, it was bought many, many years ago. So you've got a lot of gain.
Yeah, capital gain if they sell it.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're going to be losing a chunk to taxes. And it's pretty difficult at this point to get the money out. If you are, you know, if she were to gift it to him, the beneficiary, and he were to sell it, well, he would just recognize the gain, and maybe that he could take advantage of the 0% bracket if he had some, or maybe the best thing would be for her to sell it, take advantage of her 0% bracket if she has any left there. But still, you're going to be paying probably 15% federal, 9% Oregon, you're going to be giving about a quarter of it away. Another potential option is maybe not sell it. Maybe you can convert it into a business property, and if there's equity in the home and you're just needing cash, maybe the thing to do would be to take out a 50% of your equity in a mortgage, and that would give you the cash out, and then upon the parent's demise, there would be a step up in basis, and you would repay that loan. And, you know, once you would sell it, and you could skirt taxes that way. So there's just some ideas there on, I think, a fairly common situation.
I think more and more the issue of capital gains is going to be an important issue on those kinds of transactions. And, you know, there, I suppose another possibility would be some kind of a 1031 exchange, but that just delays the inevitable. That's a tax, they call it a tax-free exchange, but it really isn't. It's a tax-deferred exchange, as I understand it. And you basically transfer, essentially what you do is sell one property and get another one that you replace it with, and you don't have to pay the capital gains on the transaction until later.
That's right. But if you take any cash out in that deal, that cash would be taxable.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are the kinds of things we'd like to talk about. So anyway, we're going to start right off with the limited liability company issue. And this is a really, you know, common thing that we have in our practice. And so I thought I'd first of all talk about, so what is an LLC and how does it work? I mean, that may be, and by the way, I'm sort of abbreviating LLC as limited liability company, so I may use those terms interchangeably. But I thought that what I would do is just explain what they are. First of all, a limited liability company is a little bit like a corporation. It does the same thing in some respects. And a corporation, and the big fundamental thing about a limited liability company is that it affords the owners of the company to have no personal liability for the obligations of the company. The idea is you capitalize the company, you put money into it or property into it, and then say, for example, you have a business that's running out of it, and the property is whatever is in the corporation. Maybe you have a big long lease with some place, and the business just goes belly up. You can't do it, and this is not uncommon for business failures. Well, then the obligation of that lease, assuming that it's in the name of the LLC, is on the LLC only, and so if you have to default on that lease, then your personal assets, meaning your home and other things like that, would be exempt from collection by the creditor, the landlord, but the landlord could get whatever was in the LLC. So that's the concept of limited liability. In a corporation, you give shares. In a LLC, you give what are called membership interests. Sometimes we actually write, they call them units or shares, but either way, it's essentially a percentage of ownership in the particular LLC. And so that's what one of the things people like to have them for is to have this limited liability concept, and that's the basic function of it for the most part.
That's right. They're a fairly new beast, if you will, maybe 10, 20 years, probably 20 years old or so, and they vary by state on how LLCs are set up and exactly how the legal implications are with an LLC. But, you know, regarding the taxation of an LLC, you know, you've described the legal setup of an LLC. The taxation is really unique with an LLC because an LLC can be taxed as a sole proprietorship, a partnership, or a corporation.
And those are some really big differences, I think.
Exactly.
Those three things.
Exactly.
You know what? I think we're going to take a quick break and come back with Investing Simplified. Hopefully, you'll have thought about some questions about lease options or LLCs or independent contractors or anything else you'd like to talk to. So we'll be back in just a few minutes.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had a million
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. I know we'd all like to have $1 million, and if we had $1 million, we might even consider transferring some of our real property into a limited liability company, which is one of the subjects that we're talking about today. And we were talking partly about some of the tax differences. And Kevin was explaining that they have a unique circumstance that they can be taxed either sometimes as a sole proprietor or as a partnership or as a corporation. And so that's one thing that we're, you know, kind of explain how that might work.
Well, basically, if you want to set up an LLC, you would typically get your legal documents in order, especially if this is going to be a partnership, if there's two or more owners or members in this case, you definitely want to have a good document that lays out your operating agreements and exactly how it's going to work, just like any other partnership. So I think an LLC is a great way to go in terms of it's quite a bit simpler than all the red tape that a corporation needs. Say you're really going into business, you got a couple partners. And if you just go and get the S corporation set up, which is typically what a lot of people like to use for an active trader business, you know, there's a fair amount of meeting minutes, red tape, some things you have to go through there. LLC is quite a bit simpler to set up. And even with a single member LLC, I mean, boy, for just $100 with the state of Oregon, a one page document can get you going and get that shell around you to protect you. And then once you do that, your decisions are, okay, if it's a single member LLC, this is what's called a disregarded entity for tax purposes. It's you will still have the legal protection, but for tax purposes, there's not an entity that needs to file a separate tax return. You're actually going to report that on your Schedule C directly on your tax return. You would put it down as John Doe LLC on the Schedule C so that they know that this is the LLC that has its own employer ID number. And that's how a single member LLC disregarded entity is taxed. But once you have two or more, you can't do a sole proprietor anymore, and it's not disregarded. It's its own entity and has to file a partnership return, or you can jump through a few elections and get down to an S-corp tax structure, which isn't bad either. I mean, you're still an LLC, but you're taxed like an S-corp. And there's advantages between partnership taxation and disadvantages, and advantages to S-corp taxation and disadvantages. And that's where you need somebody like Carl or myself to take a look at what sort of business you have going. Is it an active trader business? Is it real property holdings? You know, what is going on in the LLC? And then you can decide what the tax benefits would be.
And a lot depends on what you said, that depending on what kind of business or what kind of purpose you have in mind will in some ways determine whether or not you want to go with the LLC or you want to go with a corporation of some sort.
That's right.
And as you mentioned, the S corporation is really, it's not a different kind of corporation exactly. It's just more that the corporation elects to be taxed in a certain way.
That's right.
And so and there's some very detailed limitations or rules regarding who can be an S corporation, but for the most part, most small businesses are S corporations,
they would qualify.
And most, you know, it's a pretty rare situation where they don't qualify. But it's only when you get really, really, really big, like 100 shareholders or something.
That's right.
So,
well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how an LLC is used to hold real property and why you would want to do that.
Well, absolutely. There are several reasons. First of all, is getting limited liability respecting, you know, the property. And then secondly, it can be used as an estate planning tool. But as far as limited liability goes, in other words, you don't want to have you want to insulate the assets of the limited liability company from your own personal assets, and so that if you have a failed business for some reason, and the context of that, as far as a transferring real property into a limited liability company, I tend to think of a rental property of some sort. And if you transfer the real property into a limited liability company, and then say, for example, you have anyone's ever seen Pacific Heights, the movie where the tenant is really the tenant from hell, and he just basically destroys the world under these people. But anyway, if you have something like that, or you know, somebody falls off the roof, and you forgot to pay for your liability insurance, and anyway, you get a big liability, some kind of judgment against you that came about as a result of the property that you have. And if you have a limited liability company and you have maintained it and it's properly set up and all of those things, then the worst that happens is that $1 million judgment or whatever it is will go against the assets of the limited liability company, namely the real property, but will not go to you, won't go to you personally, so that your personal residence, your personal property, other things that you have will not be affected. One of the things that a lot of people feel is the reverse is not entirely true, though. This is one of the things that where a lot of people, I think, misunderstand. That's the obligations of the LLC. In other words, the LLC owns the property. If something went wrong in the property, you know, or in the business of the LLC, it's the LLC's obligation. However, if you, as an individual, say, for example, you're driving your car and you run through one of those crosswalks and hit some little child and again, you forgot to, you know, raise your insurance level or your insurance is lapsed or something like that. And all of a sudden you've got this, you know, incredibly badly injured child, and your insurance, if you have it, doesn't anywhere come close to covering the loss, then all of a sudden they're going to sue you individually. So the question often is, you know, a lot of people will say, well, if I would have transferred my rental property to an LLC, that would be okay, right? Well, no, it wouldn't, because what would happen would be if you had transferred your rental property to an LLC, it's true that the creditor, the judgment creditor, couldn't go after your interest in the real property, but they can go after your interest because the real property is owned by the LLC. But they can go after your interest, the membership interest in the LLC. Now, if that's a single member LLC, that's probably good for them because then they get the whole thing. If it's a multiple member LLC and you have a third or something like that, then that's much less attractive to them. But you're still personally on the hook. So they would get your membership interest, and then they would get your other assets that you might have. Could conceivably force you into some kind of a bankruptcy or a number of things. But that's the distinction between the liability that you bear and the liability that the company bears. So
that's right. And if you have a question, give us a call, 503-417-7626 or 800-990-0750. And, you know, you described it real well there, Carl. It's kind of like a pyramid where at the top of the pyramid is your personal assets, which basically is everything you own, you personally. It's your LLC interest, it's your S-Corp stock, it's your investment portfolio, it's your real property, your principal residence, everything that you own. And if you do something at that top level, all of the assets going down are going to be subject to something. But if you have a LLC interest, it's more at the bottom where it's only going to be, it's a one-way a one-way window, if you will, where the liability stops right there.
Well, yeah, and it's they are very useful. I mean, because let's face it, it's maybe even more useful in an operational business of some sort, especially if you're a sole proprietor of some sort, contractor or whatever, and you're operating a business which is tends to have some risk in it, where you could get the lawsuit or get included in one without even knowing that you were going to get included in one, then it's a good protection, because then if it's really, really bad, whatever happens, you can essentially walk away from it and not have to worry about it too much, not have to be a complete bankruptcy or something. So
exactly.
One of the things I did want to point out is that the limited liability can be lost, however, by bad management, I guess you might say. Corporations, they call it, in a corporation, they call it piercing the corporate veil. But the same concepts appear to apply to a limited liability company. So, for example, if you run your LLC as though it were not a separate entity, if you run it out of your, you buy groceries with the same checking account that you pay for your truck payment that's in the LLC, and you pay for your supplies for the LLC out of your own checking account, and you commingle all of those things so that it looks like you're disregarding it as an entity. In other words, you're treating it as though it's just your pocketbook. That's one of those kinds of things that can, or an indicia that it's not really a limited liability company. Also, if you basically take all of the assets out of the company so that it really, there's no capitalization whatsoever. If you don't put anything into the company, theoretically, you're supposed to put in an amount, at least at the very beginning, in exchange for your membership interest, that reflects, what the anticipated needs of the company. And that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be a whole lot, but it's not just, you don't want to just set up an LLC with the Secretary of State and then say that's good. You want to then open up a bank. You want to get your EIN number with the federal government. You want to put some substantial money into an account because otherwise, at the very beginning, because otherwise then you really never started the company as a viable company. And if somebody looks back, they're going to say, wait a minute, they never did anything but just file the papers with the Secretary of State. And then they just ran it like their own checkbook again anyway. And they do this thing called piercing the corporate veil. It rarely works. The piercing, the limited liability is very strong, and it's very, very hard. But you have to have, and you actually have to do something that's kind of wrong to pierce that corporate veil. The most common thing is where you know, the company gets in trouble and the owner of the company basically says, oh gosh, things are really bad, and starts taking all the assets out of the company, and then says, oh gosh, I'm going to close the doors. Well, under those circumstances, the owner of the company has just basically made it impossible for the creditors to collect, and wrongfully so. And that would be one of those incidents where, and probably the most common incident where the courts would maybe look beyond that to a personal liability. But again, those situations are very rare, and it's a difficult task to get to the point where and if you run your business in any reasonable fashion and separate your bookkeeping functions from home to the business, then you're better off. So that's the kind of the concept of the limited liability. But let's get back to the nuts and bolts of transferring real property, because there are some pluses and minuses that go with this to the LLC. Very, very common transaction. First of all, you got to deed the property to the corporation or to the company. That's not a big deal. However, there's one thing that a lot of people don't know. Most property that is encumbered with a mortgage have a clause in the mortgage which is called a due on sale clause or an anti-assignment clause. And it basically says, thou shalt not sell any interest in this property or convey any interest in this property without first obtaining the written consent of the lender. So as a technical matter, you have now violated the terms of your mortgage or your trust deed, as the case may be. That means they could declare a default. Now, if you own it free and clear, that's not a problem. But, a lot of times people don't. So, the best thing is to go to your lender and say, I want it for business purposes. I want to transfer this into, Now, some of them won't like it. Some of them, they might even say no. Some of them say, go ahead. Others say, that's fine, but we got to redo the papers and it's going to cost you X dollars for us to do that.
Because it's not really to their benefit to allow you to do that, because they have less.
Well, it doesn't really they don't really lose any security in it. They just want to make sure that all of the parties are named on their obligation. But as a practical matter, they don't really lose their security in it. But banks are they're very conservative and very cautious, or at least they are now. Now, I have never, in all the years of practice, I've never really seen a financial institution declare a default and foreclose or demand that I've never seen that happen, because the last thing on earth they really want is another property. And the chances are that if you pay the mortgage, they're never going to take note of the fact that it's been transferred to an LLC, and they're not going to, they're not going to do anything about it. But there is that risk, and it's one of those things you have to know. Now, ironically, the interesting thing is, if it's residential property and you transfer it to a living trust, that does not apply, because there's a federal law that precludes the financial institution from accelerating the balance and declaring a default for that kind of a transfer if it's an estate planning, into a living trust. But if it's a commercial property, that's another matter. The same thing applies. So it's a kind of an interesting thing. And a lot of people don't want to go through the hassle of dealing with their lender to do that. But if you're worried about it and you want to follow the letter of the law, that's what you'd want to do. So the other thing is, when you do transfer a real property into an LLC, the likelihood is that you're going to have to get commercial insurance. You won't be able to keep it on your homeowner's insurance anymore, because they consider that a business property now, and that's an important thing. So those are other things that you want to consider about. The other thing, I think some of the practical things are, you want to make sure that your rental agreements, if you're renting the property to someone and you've been renting it as an individual and now you've got an LLC in there, you got to go back and have a new lease or a new rental agreement with your tenant that says the landlord is the LLC. Because you don't want to have you be in the landlord anymore, and there again, that's one of those things that you would want to do to preserve the benefits of the limited liability. So that's kind of that. But let's go back to the tax aspect of this. How do these things differ? The LLC and why would you do one or the other, or those kinds of things?
Yeah. Well, I've got a really good estate planning tip regarding this here that we'll talk about. Let's take a quick break first, and then we'll come back and talk about that. And maybe if you're not in business, how you can use this to your benefit, and what may be a scenario where it could help you if you have other real property. So we'll take a quick break and come back with these items, and we'll do that right now.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified. The sun is coming out. I understand we've got a good week ahead of us. These are the days that we live for in Oregon. So we've at least suffered through one more week of rain, and now we should be looking at a good week ahead. So, well, you know, Carl, one of the situations that this may benefit a listener who maybe isn't in business and doesn't have an active trader business, doesn't have multiple rental properties, but maybe you have an old property that has an old building on it that is uninsurable. Maybe it's not up to code, and it's a family farmstead or, you know, residence or something like that. And it's not something that you're always there to take care of, that type of a thing. This would be a good situation to put that property in an LLC. Maybe you're not even renting it, but if you were to put it into an LLC, it's cheap insurance, basically. You know, if somebody were crossing through and were to get hurt on your property, you know, for $100, how would that work in a legal standpoint?
Well, absolutely. You know, if you have the thing in an LLC, the interesting thing there is that it reminds me of a case that we had years ago where a fellow walked into a house that was being sold. And one of the things they were doing some repairs to the house to make it more saleable. And this fellow kind of showed up without the realtor just because he wanted to look at it himself. And it was kind of late in the afternoon. It was getting dark. And one of the things they'd been doing was they'd been working on something under the foundation. So they cut a big hole in the floor. And the guy, unfortunately, he walked in. It was dark. And he, assuming there was a floor there, walked into this hole and was hurt pretty bad. And then there was, obviously they sued and blamed the owner. Now, the ideal thing would be to have the LLC in place as well as the insurance.
Yes.
Because, you want some insurance coverage if you've got that kind of thing. Now, the problem is you may have if it's really bad, you may have a little trouble getting the insurance. So you're right. The LLC would be a useful tool. Unless you considered it just that purpose. If that was sort of like a fraud on creditors or something, but I suppose some clever lawyer, you know, could try to sue you. But generally, protection of a limited liability company is pretty strong.
Going to help you there, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, another scenario we do see this fairly often is where somebody has accumulated a few properties, whether they're rentals or inheritances or what have you. And one of the suggestions is maybe put each property in its own LLC to keep it separate from the other properties and from your personal assets. Now, that's kind of an extreme, if you will, but maybe it's justified. Maybe there's a property that has inherent high risk with it, on a river or, what have you. There's any number of things that can increase the risk. Or sometimes they put several properties in an LLC. Maybe they group three into one LLC, three into another. That also works and simplifies things.
Right, those are good strategies in the sense that at least for what we would call premises liability, the things that go wrong with respect to the premises.
Yeah,
you know, the guy falling off the roof. Those are things that the tenant who's claims that you've discriminated against them for whatever reason and. Files a multi-million dollar lawsuit or whatever. Those kinds of things can be very beneficial. How much do you really need, I guess, is the question. If you want to be absolutely safe, sure, go ahead and put every property separately into an LLC. But, that becomes more complex. You've got a whole bunch of K-1s that you're going to have on your tax thing. You're going to have a $100 charge a year that you got to renew with the corporation division and stuff like that.
That's right.
So you can go, like you said, it's a little bit of an extreme measure, but if that makes you feel good, it's a relatively inexpensive form of insurance as well. And there are other useful tools. One in the estate planning context is the sort of the dichotomy between Oregon and Washington. Your ownership in real property is real property. Whereas if you own membership interest in a limited liability company which owns real property, the interest you have in the limited liability company is what we call intangible property. And generally speaking, and this is the case here, if you're in Washington and you live in Washington, intangible property is taxed for inheritance tax purposes where the person lives.
In Washington.
Now, so that would mean that if you had real property here in Oregon and you had it in an LLC and then you moved and made Washington your domicile and kept your property here in the LLC, and let's suppose that it was a $3 million property, well, if you're in Oregon, there's a $1 million exemption. So you would then see at least $2 million being taxed for inheritance tax purposes. Whereas if you're in Washington, that $3 million of the value is going to be in Washington, and they have a $2 million exemption. So you just saved the tax on $1 million. So it's pretty, and a lot of people do that sort of thing, not necessarily for that reason alone, but for a kind of retired person, I tend to think that the tax system in Washington's a little kinder and gentler.
This is cutting-edge tax planning, and it's beautiful, that scenario you gave. And, just to—
Everybody moved to Washington.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you didn't completely understand that and you think you have a scenario that fits this, definitely give us a call, 503-417-7626, and we can let you know how it would affect you. But, that's just a— it's really a huge planning opportunity for those who, like you say, to repeat that example, those who live out of Oregon but have Oregon real property. If you just own that directly and you have an estate over $1 million, Oregon's going to tax you on that percent of real property to your total estate. But if it's an LLC interest, it's not property owned in Oregon anymore. It's the intangible asset in the state that you live. So it's a very real and cutting-edge planning opportunity.
And if you happen to live in Washington, our toll-free number is 800-990-0750. So anyway, that pretty much wraps up everything there is to say about LLCs, unless we had a question on it. I thought maybe we would...
I think we beat it to death.
I think we did. We beat the limited liability company to a pulp there. And so let's talk a little bit about the lease option. It's a little shorter topic, but and this is a very common transaction. It's one I don't really like very well, and I'll probably tell you why here in just a little bit. But it can be a very useful thing, but... Essentially, what a lease option is you say, for example, you're the person who owns the property. Somebody comes to you and says, you know, I want to lease this for a while, but I'd like to have the option to buy it. And I want to be able to buy it at a particular price or under certain terms. And so that's what it really does, is it allows a buyer to move into a property and lease the property for a period of time. And then if they choose to do so at some time, they get to exercise their option, and they can then purchase the property, and you, and they can force you to sell it to them at the price that you'd agreed upon, say, 3-4 years ago. And now there are many terms, as there are, you know, types of people and properties, but that's a kind of the general way it works. You know, you often see that they can lease it for 5 years, but they have an option for 5 years, meaning that, or 3 years, or 1 year, or whatever it is. And if they choose to do so, they can purchase the property under the terms and conditions that they agreed upon when you started the lease. So that's kind of the basic concept of it. Now, one of the things that is, you know, the first thing that is problematic with that is that the people now are in possession of your property, and they have an option. And the option is prevents you from selling it to somebody else. So if somebody comes along, say for the day after you sign the lease option agreement, and some new buyer comes along and says, "Hey, I'd like to buy your property for, you know, $50,000 more than you were going to sell it to the the option guy." You can't do it unless the option guy lets you. So it ties up your property for the period of the option. Going back to the option, though, the option has to have what we call separate consideration, meaning, and usually it's structured like this: it says, "Okay, I'll pay you $X thousand for the option, and then we'll lease it under these terms." And in other words, they're almost like two separate transactions. And usually what happens is they then say, and the lease option price or some portion of the lease option price will be the option amount that you paid, if they exercise the option, will count towards the purchase price. If they don't exercise the option, they forfeited that amount. So sometimes they just say, no, you got $5,000 or $10,000 for the option, and whether and that's it. Whether you ever exercise it or not, you know, you lose it. You're basically starting over. It's important to structure those carefully, because you don't want to have it, you know, you don't want to have some fights over it. But besides that, it also puts you into a situation where you now have you now have somebody in possession of your property, which is always a risk with a landlord situation, because there are things that happen. And if it's a residential, and let's face it, usually the reason people want a lease option, the usual reason, not always, but the usual reason is because their financial circumstances are such that they can't get a loan to buy it. I mean, that's usually why people do that. Not always. There are reasons. They're only going to be here so long or whatever. But as a practical matter, that always, you know, selling to the least qualified buyer is not always the best choice for people to do that. So anyway, that's one other concern. And then another thing that happens is that you now, if it's a residence, you now have these people in your property, and they tied up your property, so you can't really sell it until the option period runs. Or you get permission, and you now have subjected yourself to the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act here in Oregon. And that is one of the most technically applied laws in Oregon, and there are relatively few lawyers who really understand it well. And it tends to be a huge minefield for the landlord. And usually it shows up in various ways. So other obstacles or difficulties with the lease option is the person gets into your property and you know, either commits what we call waste. You know, they trash the place, or they turn it into an environmental hazard. You know, the meth lab, the, you know, if you've got somebody who's running a home style garage and they, you know, they're changing the oil and dumping it in the backyard and, you know, those kinds of things. All of those kinds of things can be troublesome. Anybody who rents property probably is aware of all of that, and they probably have lots of provisions that say that you can't do that. But nonetheless, you have to be mindful of all of those things. So my tendency is to – oh, the other thing is that that if you have this situation, then it's more vulnerable or gives you less protection in the event that the person who is in your property files bankruptcy. So for all of those reasons, I don't really like them. If they're good, honorable people and they do what they said, it works fine. If they are people who either aren't honorable or are people who just run into bad times and things go wrong, either way, the lease option ends up being not so good for the seller. But it can work. I'm not totally, you know, saying it can't work. I just say that there are a lot of pitfalls to it.
Well, it seems that you as the seller are taking all of the risk with the lease option. In other words, you're locking in a price that maybe 5 years later, the buyer can decide, okay, hey, I can buy this property at this price. If it went down in value, they're not going to buy it. But if it went up in value, they would buy it.
Exactly. And theoretically, that's that risk factor, that being off the market kind of factor that is built into the option, the purchase price of the option. So just imagine if you had done that in, say 2 years or 3 years ago, and they want to make, you know, they had a price and they said, well, okay, it's $200,000, and then it's now gone up to, you know, it's worth $400,000, and you have this option price for $200,000. You know, it can be a rough deal. So anyway, one of the things that I just in that situation, I tend to prefer either a land sale contract or a note and trust deed, which would then essentially leave a lien in the favor of the seller, so that in the event that something went wrong, they could foreclose. It's not the best remedy or the easiest remedy, but it is a good remedy and it's a solid remedy. And it also, in almost all circumstances, survives a bankruptcy. So that's a good thing. And also just one little, this is sort of a proverb that I have, which says, remember, nice guys finish last in real estate. So, we've seen, particularly in the lease situation, we've seen so many landlords who try to be kind and helpful and considerate of their tenants who, you know, they kind of lose out. And then, of course, they become extremely jaded over the whole thing. And for all of the really, really good people who rent all the time, and, you know, you don't hear about those. It's the bad ones that we hear about anyway. So it's not to say leasing and stuff is always bad, because it's not. But it does have some perils, and you just need to go in with your eyes open. So maybe we ought to take a little quick break here and come back. This is Investing Simplified, and you're listening to 970 AM, and we will be back in just a couple of minutes and talk about some more common misunderstood transactions.
Just the way you say goodnight to me brings the feeling out inside of me.
Hello. This is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had a
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we've been talking about common transactions, and one of these things which is maybe one of the most commonly misunderstood concept is the independent contractor versus employee. And unfortunately, the law makes it very complicated. And so there are a lot of small businesses who want to employ an independent contractor. And why is that? Well, if you are truly an independent contractor, you know, that's working for you, then you don't have to pay their workers' compensation insurance. You don't have to pay unemployment. You don't have to do tax withholding. And so in many ways, and they don't have to participate in your benefits plans if you have one as an employer. Now, the problem is that most people, the biggest problem is that it's kind of difficult to be an independent contractor. Quite frankly, an independent contractor pretty much has to be independently in business, working for a number of other people, have a business license if that's required, advertise their services, and they basically have to be a separate business for all purposes, that is, in order to qualify as an independent contractor for the various purposes. One of the problems, and we're not going to be able to cover this all today, but one of the big problems with an independent contractor is that depending on which law you're looking at, they're the terms and the requirements to be a legitimate independent contractor are different. And so you have rules that fit under workers' comp. You have rules that fit under the unemployment division, and rules that fit under as far as the Internal Revenue Service is concerned. And also, there are rules that come under the common law as to the rule of agency. In other words, an independent contractor, you know, you the employer of an independent contractor, can't generally be sued for the negligence of an independent contractor. But, so the test for who qualifies is different in all of those circumstances. So that's the subject of a much longer instruction, if you will.
And, you know, I think it affects a lot of people. You know, maybe you're working for Intel, and it's pretty clear they do a good job of knowing who's an employee and who's an independent contractor. So, you know, you get your W-2, you're an employee, you're part of their benefits plan, that's fine and going forward. But, you know, maybe you're working for a smaller company, maybe, you've kind of got a piecemeal part-time job, and, you know, this company is treating you as an independent contractor. Well, that's to your detriment. The IRS generally doesn't like businesses to go the independent contractor route if possible. Now, they, you know, like you said, there's a whole section here, and it's not black and white. It's a 20-point test of facts and circumstances, whether somebody's independent contractor or an employee. But they typically want businesses to treat somebody as an employee, to pay the employment taxes, workers' comp, exactly as you described. And a small business can, you know, try to skirt that, save some money. But if you're treating people as independent contractors and it comes to light that they're not, it's a bad road to go down as a business.
Well, it is, because not only have you not paid the withholding or the unemployment insurance or the workers' comp insurance, then it also, in some of those instances, imposes personal liability on you, the company owner, for those things and or claims that might arise under workers' comp. So that could all be very, very expensive. And it's the other thing that's most commonly misunderstood is just because you have an agreement that says the person is an independent contractor means nothing. Because the determination of what constitutes an independent contractor is the factual situation that gives rise to the various factors that are looked at. You know, do you work there full time? Do you have are you able to control the manner and time that you do and use the tools of your own purchase to do your work? You know, a whole lot of factors that come into play that determine whether or not you're an independent contractor or not.
And even if both parties agree that you want to be taxed that way, well, chances are the IRS isn't going to get involved or even know about it. But that still has no, that's what you're talking about, that has no weight whatsoever.
And they're going to look back on it and they're going to look at the facts and stuff like
that's
that.
Right.
And as a general rule, if there's a consideration that you might be an employee, you probably are. And so it's generally better to default to treating people as an employee. So what are some examples of really, you know, legitimate kinds of independent contractors? Okay, so for example, you're a small business, maybe you have some employees doing some stuff, but you're not very good at bookkeeping. So you hire your bookkeeping out to somebody else, okay? And they do bookkeeping for a whole lot of other firms. They advertise and they've got their own little space in a office building and stuff. That's an independent contractor. That sort of thing. Maybe you want to deliver goods, but you don't want to have a truck. You don't want to have the expense of an employee that goes out and delivers stuff. So you hire a delivery service to do it, and they have their own truck, they have their own advertisement, they have their own stuff, and that person is probably an independent contractor. They go out and they crash the truck, and they injure somebody. It's on their nickel, not yours.
Yeah.
So
another scenario would be maybe you need janitorial or cleaning services. And somebody has their own business. They offer that service to multiple people, maybe to other businesses, maybe to households. Maybe they go and maybe they're a housekeeper for a few hours each day. Well, that person's an independent contractor. But if you're hiring a person and you're the only person they're working for,
they're an employee.
it's leaning toward employee and a household employee on top of that.
Right.
And that's got some reporting rules on its own, and so it's very important to tread this. In fact, this is where Tim Geithner got in trouble. Was he had somebody working? This is the former IRS commissioner. He had somebody working in his house, and he didn't pay them as an employee. He treated them as an independent contractor, and he didn't pay the employment taxes.
I am shocked.
You are.
I am.
Yes.
I really.
So that's it's a. Definitely an area that it doesn't take much to look at and see your exposure. You know, giving Carl a call or myself, we can help you wade through that.
Yeah, there are some situations I know of that where this worked out badly. One was a computer manufacturer that manufactured in the days when people had little shops that they built computers, and they had five or six people who were technicians, basically, in their building, and they came in 8 to 5 every day, and they didn't work anywhere else. They didn't have any advertising. They weren't licensed. They didn't have corporations. They were just people. And
screams
and
employee.
They had
to
this
me.
Nice agreement that said we're an independent contractor, and they weren't. And employer had to pay the piper for that one. So anyway, we're getting to the end of our show today. Thank you so much for listening. We hope that next week you'll be with us. Chuck will be back then, and we should have a very good show for you, and I'm sure he'll have some really interesting things to tell you about. And again, thank you for listening. This is Investing Simplified. Have a wonderful week.
Financial Group Wealth Management. Price Financial Group Wealth Management.